We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrix. Joining me today is Chris Grove, President and Director of Commerce Resources. How are you today, Chris?
Yeah, just fine, Tom. Good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Great to have you back on the show. And, you know, we're going to talk today about something that doesn't get nearly as much attention as, let's say, gold or silver, but is really integral and essential in moving the world in this green direction. So why don't we start by reminding our listeners what rare earth elements are and why they're so vitally important to the electrification story of the world?
Sure, absolutely. So the rare earth elements are 15 to 17 different commodities grouped together. And then what is really important in out of that 17 are really four rare earth elements, which are essential to manufacture permanent magnets. And it is then those permanent magnets that essentially chase each other. And different manufacturers have videos on this, like Stanley Black & Decker, and you can see these rare earth element magnets chasing each other, and it's unbelievable. But, you know, more specifically, if you've ever dried your hands in a Dyson air hand dryer, or if you've got a Dyson vacuum cleaner, or if you bought a new leaf blower, as we did last year, which almost levitates itself once it's turned on, that is the power of rare earth magnets. And so the four rare earth elements that are used for magnet manufacture are neodymium, praseodymium, terbium, and dysprosium. And ultimately, like 96% of all electric vehicles have rare earth element permanent magnet drive motors. And Tesla was essentially the last major manufacturer to come over to rare earth element permanent magnet drive motors. When they first came to market, mainly to try to reduce the sticker price of a Tesla, they went for an AC induction motor, which ultimately is not very good, creates a lot of drag, it's heavy, et cetera, et cetera. And that arguably, if you know those videos of burning Teslas, that's really because of the stress it puts on the lithium ion battery. And so when rare earth elements essentially fell in price off of their stratospheric highs in 2011, then finally, like in 2017 or 2018, Tesla signed an agreement with a Chinese rare earth element magnet manufacturer in 2017. And a year later, they came out with their rare earth element permanent magnet drive motors. Whereas Tesla's always had rare earth elements motors in all of the small motors, you know, for windshield wipers, seats, windows, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, in this drive for a cleaner, greener world, it is all going to be electrified. And no matter what the power source is, you are going to then provide power to these electric motors, where the fundamental of them is these rare earth element magnets chasing each other.
So, Chris, are they not only contained in, let's say, the leaf blowers and hand dryers, but like you said, most of the electric cars, but aren't these materials integral to, let's say, wind power generation as well?
Oh, yeah. So wind turbines, absolutely. That's a huge market for these rare earth element magnets. Absolutely. But I mean, it's really anything that has an electric motor, you know, whether it's a chainsaw or, you know, an electric toothbrush. I mean, really, everything that's got an electric motor probably has, most of them have rare earth element permanent magnets chasing each other inside the motor. Mm-hmm.
So, Chris, before we hit record, you kind of laid out a little bit to me about how China has really kind of come into the market and dominated the market for a long time. So why don't we kind of lay out the roadmap a little bit about how they tried to corner the market, and then we can kind of get into how more domestic manufacturing in the West has come online to be able to get around this cornering of the market that they've tried to do.
Sure, absolutely. We had a very friendly association with the previous management of the Mountain Pass mine in California, which was the first significant rare earth element producing mine in the world, and their head geologist, you know, mentioned to me one time that they allowed the Chinese in to view the Mountain Pass operations in the mid 1990s, and then essentially the Chinese went back home and through incredible state subsidies, figured out how to improve, optimize that processing. And then in the late 1990s, early 2000s, China basically flooded the market with rare earth elements. And that was one of the primary reasons that that Mountain Pass mine shut down in 2002.
Pass is in California, right?
Yeah, right on the California-Nevada border, yes. And so Mountain Pass shut down. Also, there was an environmental issue with their processing at that point in time. But they shut down in 2002. And then there were about 3 years of relative quiet in the rare earth element market. And then in the summer of 2005, China imposed an export duty on their rare earth elements. And that was fundamentally a drive to increase jobs, really, at the end of the day, manufacturing jobs downstream, and everybody that was active or was a buyer, a customer of rare earth elements, basically moved their processing or their manufacturing facilities to China to access the cheaper priced domestic feedstock. Let me just say that export duty 6 or 7 years later was declared illegal by the WTO. But what China also did in 2005 was essentially created the opportunity or the impetus for there to be an alternate source of rare earth elements to China. We were actually contacted by an American magnet manufacturer in 2005 who essentially informed me of all of this stuff. And then I did my due diligence and found it all to be true. But as he said, listen, my profit margin basically evaporated overnight. And he says, we need a domestic source of rare earth elements, which there wasn't at that point in time in 2005. And then, of course, in September of 2010, in supposed retaliation for a territorial dispute between China, cut off all supplies of rare earth elements to the world's second largest market, Japan, in an incident which is referred to as the Senkaku boat incident. And basically, it was because a Chinese fishing boat was fishing in the waters off of the Senkaku Islands, which the Japanese believe are theirs. And then the fishing boat captain rammed two Japanese Coast Guard trawlers, two of them, rammed them. And so the Japanese arrested the Chinese fishing boat captain. And in retaliation, the Chinese cut off all supplies of rare earth elements to Japan for about 6 to 8 weeks. And the rare earth element prices went absolutely ballistic. So of those four I previously mentioned, for an example, dysprosium oxide was in 2010 traded at about $90 a kilo. And within 6 months, it was trading at $3,000 a kilo. It went up over 30 times in value in a matter of months. Insanity, absolute insanity. What followed then also made complete sense because then the rare earth elements got so expensive, everybody on planet Earth tried to substitute or design them out. Now, the interesting thing is that after 6 or 7 years, most of the planet or the majority of planet Earth decided that there were no viable substitutes for the manufacture of permanent magnets, and rare earth element prices had fallen back to a point where there was really no reason to continue to look for substitutes. Now, having said that, now you're talking about 2017, and then in the midsummer of 2017, the rare earth element prices basically doubled overnight. And there was some Chinese excuse for that, but kind of it was like, well, we can do it, so why don't we do it? And they did. And then prices again kind of fell off for a couple of years. But what I would say, if this is still hopefully on point, is right now what we're seeing in rare earth elements is continued increased values of rare earth elements, which arguably speaks to the one of the major underlying factors, which is significant increased global demand against major issues on the supply side. The other funny thing is, and I will give Beijing credit for this, in the last 2 5-year plans, Beijing has done a very good job in shutting down polluting mining and processing projects. But that has also then made China a net importer of rare earth elements. And so it is a very different dynamic today than it was even 5 years ago, let us say. Mm-hmm.
As you say, Chris, with them importing more of their raw feedstock, you had shared with me a quote as well, kind of outlining that this raw material squeeze on China would develop into a full-blown crisis in the near term. So how could that happen?
Well, this then speaks to a couple of things. In the last decade, and gently at first, maybe, but really in the last year, much more dramatically, demand has increased. And so, you know, a decade ago, rare earth element prices were on this fairly significant fall off from the crazy heights they got to following the Senkaku boat incident, while at the same time, demand continued to increase globally. So where we are today, 10 years later, is that global demand has doubled for rare earth elements, while at the same time, there's really only one new major producer of rare earth elements in operation right now, and that's Lynas. Secondly, and most notably, though, I would say, is the Mountain Pass mine, which was brought back into operation in 2011, 2012, which then under the previous management went bankrupt in 2015. And then the debt holders brought it back into operation in 2017. And MP Materials right now is doing incredibly well. And so I do want to mention that. But, you know, fundamentally, rare earth elements are an extremely challenging commodity. And the word rare in their name comes from essentially the challenges to make these deposits economic. So, you know, over the last decade, you've seen essentially the restart of Mountain Pass, and you've seen the production or the new production of one major mine on planet Earth. That's basically it. Mm-hmm. So the crisis that was talked about in that quote, I think, is very accurate, mainly because rare earth elements are very challenging in terms of finding economic deposits.
So considering all of that, Chris, why could we see a demand shock to this market? And what are, if we could compare for us, the demand shock versus a supply shock and how they're fundamentally different?
Sure. Well, so the Senkaku boat incident is a classic supply shock. So that was China cutting off all supply to the world's second largest buyer, Japan, and prices went crazy. Were the Chinese guilty that the prices went crazy, or was it the rest of the world overreacting? I don't know, six of one, half dozen of the other. But the reality, as I said, dysprosium from $90 a kilo to $3,000 a kilo, crazy, crazy. So that was a supply shock. A demand shock essentially is very fundamentally different in so much as recent news releases. For example, MP Materials and General Motors. MP Materials announcing the intent to construct a 200,000 square foot magnet manufacturing facility in Fort Worth, Texas. And on the same news release, announced a binding agreement to supply General Motors with all of the permanent magnets it needs for its fleet of electric vehicles. And I'm drawing a blank here today, but just an item I just saw on my feed this morning was it's a car company, and it was like all of their vehicles by 2030 are going to be electric. It's Renault. But I mean, the European manufacturers European countries are much more aggressive in terms of, i.e. Limiting internal combustion engine vehicles. I think Norway is the first one with a complete ban on internal combustion engine vehicles by 2024. But most EU countries have some kind of a ban, you know, slated to occur. Mm-hmm. And you have this significant sea change of automotive manufacturers switching over to electric vehicles. You know, Ford, everybody basically. Now, a year ago or 2 years ago, I think the last stats I saw that I can actually quote, I think were from 2020, and the U.S. car market was broken up. But California was by far the most electric vehicle friendly state. And even in that state, in I think 2020, it was still 81% of vehicles bought were internal combustion engine vehicles. Well, I would expect that that number for 2022 is going to be, I don't know, maybe 50% of new vehicles bought are going to be internal combustion engine vehicles. And I could be very wrong on that. But the bottom line is that the demand shock is about, you know, a much greater percentage of planet Earth realizing we have a huge problem here, and we have to do everything in our power to positively affect this warming planet trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like the supply shock goes back to that old saying of the cure for high prices are high prices, right? There's a fairly easy road to either try to replace or find ways around the high price of sourcing that material versus demand wise. There's no way to, you know, stop this progression towards the electrification, right?
Totally. And the other side of it, and I'm glad you mentioned it as well, is ultimately the supply shock can be addressed and rectified fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, China just started shipping material back to Japan. But ultimately, that did trigger, again, this 6 or 7 year global R&D drive to find substitutes for rare earth elements, which was primarily unsuccessful. And so that is also very interesting. And the commentators who have made these quotes about the demand shock have also referenced this point. Listen, the planet has already gone down this country road. The planet has looked for 6 or 7 years for substitutes to rare earth element permanent, to rare earth elements for permanent magnets, and have come back empty-handed. The one thing that has happened, and this is also fundamentally important in terms of a consideration of rare earth element projects, again, because every project has a slightly different distribution of the 17 rare earth elements, and arguably people should be looking at the ones that have the best distribution of the four magnet feed rare earth elements. But in terms of those four and in terms of their current prices, the one laggard in terms of price appreciation is dysprosium. So as you said, there's nothing like high prices to cure high prices. So dysprosium, which was at $3,000 a kilo in 2011, it's currently at about $460 a kilo. Now, you would think, wow, that's a huge price drop. And it is. But if you think about dysprosium in 2010 or early 2010 being at $90 a kilo, and it being at four times its value, and it's the laggard. Well, look where gold was in 2010. You know, maybe $1,800 an ounce. Is it four times that today? Is it at $7,000 an ounce? If it is, you know, let's stop this interview and I'll go buy Barrick or something. It's not. And so the reality is that rare earth element prices, or the four for magnet feeds, the other three have appreciated very much more than dysprosium has. Mm-hmm. So the one rare earth element that has taken up most of the slack in terms of the percentage of a permanent magnet that dysprosium gave up is terbium. And so terbium in 2012, in our economics, we used terbium at $764 a kilo. This week, in the price report we get from Beijing, it went over $2,000 a kilo. It's $2,010.50 a kilo. So almost a tripling of terbium's price in the last decade, which amazing. And part of that design change, just to be very clear, was that historically dysprosium was about 13% of a permanent magnet, and now dysprosium is only 1%. So again, you know, that change in the downstream market does affect arguably people's impressions of what are the most attractive rare earth element projects.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to just step back to the supply side issue again, Chris, if you wouldn't mind. How much of a, let's say, a gap are we going to see develop over the medium term here? Let's say the next 5 to 8 years out to 2030. What does the deficit of production look like?
That is really tough to answer. It's a great question, Tom. And people all over planet Earth are struggling with that right now. What I would say as part of an answer to that in something that is arguably unquantifiable at this point in time, what I would say is that relatively quietly, there are lots of governments, but more importantly, lots of industrialists working to reduce or eliminate China as a supplier. While at the same time, there are lots of guys in the same position as I am trying to bring a rare earth element mine into production. And again, how much success is there going to be in that latter camp? I don't want to be a negative Nancy, but rare earth elements are an extremely challenging commodity to be economic. And so it's a really tough question to answer. And, you know, rare earth elements aren't really playing a part, for an example, in the shortage of microchips and semiconductors. Rare earth elements are just used in a very small amount in terms of doping those semiconductors and microchips. But you've already got an issue over on in that commodity. And I hate to say it, but I think that is really small potatoes in terms of this supply gap that may be developing over the next 5 years. I think that supply gap will be surprising to everyone.
So, Chris, the last time we spoke, we were kind of talking about the domestic production side, or let's say domestic for the West production side of the rare earth elements. So, you know, we talked about Mountain Pass as a mine that's producing the ore. I believe it was Energy Fuels that is processing the ore in Utah. And there was one more step of the metallization process that was happening in the UK. So have there been any developments since the last time we spoke to really try and streamline the process within the West?
Well, more capital has been thrown at the issue, and MP Materials did raise $545 million in a SPAC in October of 2020. And so they are very hard at work on setting up their own internal processing. One of the first things they did was pay out their Chinese partner. Currently, I still believe they are shipping concentrate to China for processing, but their top priority is having their own internal processing to process their own material. The company in the UK, Less Common Metals, I haven't spoken to them recently, and arguably an issue there would be feedstock. In terms of Energy Fuels and their continued places being the only rare earth element processor in North America, they're currently looking for more sources of monazite-hosted rare earth elements, and monazite-hosted sources typically have the highest percentage of those four rare earth elements for the manufacture of permanent magnets. Another company to mention that is doing arguably very well is Neo Performance Materials, the Canadian company, and they have facilities in Estonia. So they would be the only rare earth element processor in the European Union, and they're definitely looking at increasing their business in the European Union for those European manufacturers, auto manufacturers, wind turbine manufacturers, everyone like that, including the German magnet manufacturer by the name of Vacuum Schmelze, as well. I would say just generally, there's an increase of activity in the United States by people expecting to produce permanent magnets, such as MP Materials in this 200,000 square foot facility, Urban Mining in Texas, and them constructing their facility primarily from the $28.8 million they received from the U.S. Department of Defense in October of 2020. So there's a lot of activity. I don't have any more specifics than that, Tom, but there is a lot of very concerned companies working very hard, as I say, to reduce or eliminate China as a source of supply. Mm-hmm. Whether it's for raw material or whether it's for the downstream products from rare earth elements like the magnets. And of course, in terms of thinking about all of this, there is this new legislation proposed by Tom Cotton in the United States, which would, if it was passed, make it illegal for any U.S. defense contractor to source anything basically from a Chinese producer or manufacturer. The slated date for that to become law would be 2026. It has not yet passed. It's not actual it's proposed legislation at this point in time. However, there are certain factors in that are already law. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. If you're looking at that Cotton legislation, there is some stuff in that already apparently is law. Although mm-hmm. this final piece about making it illegal for U.S. defense contractors is not yet law yet.
So, Chris, what are some different ways for people to really invest in this trend? Are there ETFs for the metals or the miners? How are there different ways of actually investing to try and capitalize on this trend?
Well, there's two rare earth element funds that I know of. There's the Van Eck REE ETF, and then there's also another fund, which is not surprisingly named the Rare Earth Element Fund, REE Fund, and it is operated out of Geneva. So both of them have a different mix distribution of companies they're invested in. The Rare Earth Element Fund out of Geneva does have some Chinese companies in that. And I'm not saying that doesn't make sense. I mean, China still is the dominant single country of production, no question about that. But the fund in Geneva also has a major position in Linus. Besides that, of course, companies that are working to advance a rare earth element project would be another way to invest. And one of the things I would point out is that even the rare earth element majors I've mentioned today, specifically MP Materials and Neo Performance Materials, they are not yet trading above their 52-week highs that they both hit in January or Q1 of 2021 last year, when rare earth element prices again did some crazy spike through late Q4 2020 and early Q1 2021. And then in Q2 of 2021, prices fell like into an open elevator shaft, which was arguably because everybody saw the price spike and everybody who needs rare earth elements stockpiled in Q1. And then nobody bought in Q2. The other side of it, or the reality today, is that in like June of 2021, prices started appreciating, and now they're at a level much higher than they were a year ago. But there's this disconnect between especially the rare earth element prices today and the juniors working in rare earth elements. We're currently at 50% of our 52-week high, which we hit in January of last year. MP Materials is close to their 52-week high, but I think they're trading at like $44, $45 a share right now, when their 52-week high is like $54. Neo Performance is trading at like $19 a share, and I think its 52-week high is like $21. So they're close. Mm-hmm. And Energy Fuels is doing well, but Energy Fuels also has this exposure to uranium, and so they're also benefiting from Eric Sprott cornering the market on uranium and that significant increase in the value of uranium. But for investors, I would say, look to companies advancing rare earth element projects, early stage, late stage, or these two funds. Mm-hmm.
So, Chris, maybe give us a quick overview on the different types of host minerals that these different projects are held in, and let's say some of the advantages and disadvantages of each?
Sure. So there's really two things. There's geology and then there's mineralogy. So different geological bodies can, again, rare earth elements, as so many pundits say, you know, wanting to be kind of, you know, the skunk at the tea party or whatever, or liking for the irony of the name, et cetera, saying, well, rare earth elements are actually very well distributed. They are. But here's the thing. Rare earth elements in any type of rock that is not a carbonatite, and I'm talking a peralkaline, a pegmatite, none of those deposits have ever been commercialized. There are two types of geology that host rare earth elements that can be economic. The dominant one, which produces over 80%, or I should say, over 80% of rare earth element production, comes from carbonatite hard rock sources. The other approximate 20% comes from ionic clay deposits, which are very, very different. Now, in terms of then, besides the geology, then you get into mineralogy. And this is something that does occur in other commodities, like, say, nickel. You would much rather have a massive sulfide nickel deposit like Voisey's Bay over a laterite nickel deposit, which is only going to be economic in a country that has very, very low labor costs. So in terms of rare earth elements, times that by like 100. So there are over 150 different rare earth element bearing minerals, but there are only four that have ever been commercially processed or made are economic. And those four are led by monazite. So the world's largest rare earth element mine is Bayanobo in Baotou, China. It is a carbonatite that is monazite dominant. Second to that would be bastnasite-hosted carbonatite deposits, and that would be Mountain Pass in California. However, that brings in the slight difference or significant difference between the monazite percentage of rare earth elements, the four rare earth elements for magnet manufacturing, and bastnasite-hosted deposits. And monazite-hosted deposits typically have a higher percentage of those four magnet feeds. Then the other two rare earth element minerals that have been commercialized on planet Earth over the last 30 years, one of them is called loperite. And loperite is really only found in the western reaches of Russia, in the Kola Peninsula. And that loperite-hosted material actually is the feedstock for neo-performance materials in Estonia. And the final one, and these deposits are very, very, very rare, but is a mineral called xenotime. And certain deposits have a little bit of xenotime, like our deposit. And then there are other deposits that are xenotime dominant, like Namibia Rare Earths in Namibia, the Lofdal deposit, or Browns Range, which is run by Northern Minerals in Australia. Those are xenotime dominant projects. So this whole mineralogy, geology factors are things that don't typically aren't typically a problem for other commodities, but they're a major issue for rare earth element projects.
Excellent, Chris. So, you know, one of the other, you know, issues that you've brought up here, especially with the move towards a more ESG friendly framework for all of these companies, you had brought up how Mountain Pass had to shut down their mine at one point because of some environmental problems. How is the rare earth, let's say, sector of mining viewed in the world through an environmental lens, let's say, compared to some of the other types of mining operations from this environmental standpoint?
Thank you. And I'm glad to answer that question because, again, as I referenced, you know, as so many journalists and pundits like to go for the irony of the situation, oh, rare earth elements are going to make the world a better place. And then they comment, while at the same time, they're destroying the world. Well, that's not factually true. What is factually true is that historically, China's extractive and processing methods were horribly environmentally degrading, but those aspects are not inherent, intrinsic in the mining or the processing of rare earth elements. The mining and processing of rare earth elements isn't any more harmful than, you know, mining any other commodity. And I'm serious. I mean, certainly, anybody who's cognizant of the gold processing, you know, with cyanide leaching, et cetera, you know, I mean, people don't do that anymore. Or they certainly don't do that in most jurisdictions. It's a similar situation to even China. And as I mentioned earlier, a credit to Beijing is that they have shut down these most excessive, egregious, environmentally damaging mining projects in China. And that is what's led China to become a net importer. So rare earth element mining is not specifically harmful to the environment at all. And Mountain Pass Materials have done an extremely good job to be as clean and green as is possible in a mining scenario. And that obviously is the way that you would have to be for a mining operation in Canada. And that is certainly our intent as well. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Chris. You know, I think we've touched on a good amount of the rare earth element world here. Is there anything else that maybe I missed or that we should chat about before we wrap up here?
I think we've done a really good job. I mean, I think we've answered most of the questions about the commodity today, Tom. I'm certainly always happy to answer any other questions you or your viewers might have. And I certainly appreciate your time today. I think I'm trying to think if there's anything that we've left out of the equation. And I think the only thing I would say is that rare earth elements are arguably, if you wanted to compare them to the battery metals, the one thing I would say is that there's continued R&D to find the most optimal economic battery for an electric vehicle. And we are well aware of that. And lithium ion certainly seems to be leading the pack right now. And rare earth elements are used in several of the battery designs, no question. But it's not a major market for rare earth elements. But what I wanted to point out or highlight is that ongoing R&D has not yet been settled in terms of the battery, where arguably the planet has already gone through that R&D in terms of the electric motors. And so even if prices got a little bit higher, I'm not really sure that the world is going to have much success on trying to design out rare earth elements again, because it already went through that and tried to do that, you know, for 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Chris. Why don't you share with us the best way to continue learning about this trend or about Commerce Resources as well?
Certainly Commerce Resources tries to educate all of our shareholders and investors as much as we can, certainly about our own Ashram Rare Earth Element and Fluorspar deposit in Nunavik, Quebec. But we also try to keep our investors aware of macro events. But I would throw out a prop to a publication online that's called the Rare Earth Observer. And this is the product of one guy out of Singapore by the name of Thomas Kroemer. And I think he does a very good job. And I don't think there's any cost to it, but he publishes, you know, kind of once a week. And he really generally does a pretty deep dive on all of the micros and the macros going on in the rare earth element sector. Besides that, of course, the Rare Earth Element Fund out of Geneva, they also do publish on a regular basis, once a week thereabouts, kind of an update on events and what thinking for the future. And finally, I would strongly recommend, although this is not inexpensive, but anyone who really wants to do a deep dive in their due diligence on rare earth elements, then I would recommend Adamas Intelligence. And that's run by a Canadian guy by the name of Ryan Castillou, and ADAMAS, Adamas Intelligence. Excellent reports, very comprehensive on the rare earth element sector.
Excellent, Chris. Well, I really appreciate you enlightening us on the rare earth element side of things today, and look forward to speaking with you again.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Tom. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.